KFMB, San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. Actually, tonight it's just Richard. Joe has taken Sunday night off. So it's going to be Richard only. And if you guys miss Joe, just send us an email. I'm just kidding. But we've got a really special guest tonight, and so I don't want to waste any time blathering on about what I did this week. Because we've got the CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation with us. That would be Mr. Don M. Green, who's got a great new book out that I just finished reading. Don, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
I'm good, Richard. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So, you were actually, this is actually a call-in show because you're on the road again, but you were actually just in San Diego last week, right?
Yes, I guess 3 days.
What were you doing here?
Greg Greed, who we did 3 Feet from Gold, and Sharon Lecter, who's a Rich Dad Poor Dad, and a lot of other well-knowns were there for an event, and I spoke and did some interviews and signed books for about 3 hours. It was a great event. It was some real neat people there.
Yeah, Greg Reed, best-selling author, 3 Feet from Gold. Sharon Lechner, of course. The event was called Secret Knot. Yeah, you were also filmed for a upcoming documentary that's coming out in October, right?
Yes, I was. Our next book's coming out in October with Penguin, and we did a film interview with myself and some other people that's involved as a promotion thing. The book is done with from Penguin, and if they absolute work involved in it, it promises to be a bestseller.
What's the name of that book?
It's called Stickability.
Now, you don't know this, but I'm the associate producer of that film. That's me.
Okay. The event is great. It's a great story, and some just terrific individuals involved in the thing, and a good message for these days, because I just believe that's the biggest thing. Hill, that's a term. I don't know where the origination of it was, but Hill used that word term, and I ran across it got the idea. I remember reading Steve Jobs.
It's going to be exciting, but I didn't want to, since you've got a new book out, that's really what I want to plug.
Okay.
I just wanted to sort of get some background. But for our listeners, so let's go back in history. You are the CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Let's start at the beginning, as they say. Tell us about the story of Napoleon Hill and who Napoleon Hill is.
Well, I happen to live in Wise, Virginia, which is home of Napoleon Hill. He was born here in 1883. His mom died at a very early age, and his dad remarried, as most men don't wait a long time. But his stepmother was a widow woman. Her husband had been a high school principal. Her father was a medical doctor. So all of a sudden, the family's got somebody in the family that's educated. And she encouraged Napoleon at an early age, and actually traded a gun for a typewriter and taught him how to type. She had him writing stories when he was 13 years old. And that blossomed into a career. He went to a 2-year high school, then took a business course, and he went to work for a man by the name of Rufus Ayers, who's quite a gentleman, probably the richest person in the county. He was a story in himself, and Hill was inspired by him and wanted to go to work for him. So he went from there to working for him, and then this guy had been in the Civil War, had read law and passed law, had been attorney general of the state of Virginia, but he'd been in coal mining, lumber business, developed hotels. His big mansion still stands about 10 minutes from here. And he thought, well, the way to make it was a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So he talked his brother into going to law school. They went to Georgetown to law school. And he convinced his brother that, hey, I can make enough money to pay her both our way through by writing. It didn't exactly work out that way. He did get a job with Bob Taylor, who was a former governor and a U.S. senator from Tennessee, to write stories for Bob Taylor's magazines. And Hill did not finish law school, though his brother did. He started doing interviews, and one of the first interviews with Andrew Carnegie, because he was interviewing successful people. And Carnegie had came over here as a 10-year-old from Scotland, first job a little over $1 a week, working in as a bobbin boy in a textile place. But he had been inspired to read by one of the people he was around later and became ultra-successful, me at an early age, by investment in the Pullman cars. At the,
The railroad cars.
The railroad tracks.
Right.
And so he became wealthy. And he attributed it to books, but he challenged Napoleon when Napoleon was interviewed him in his big mansion. This was the latter part of Carnegie's his life in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I know all these people. I can give you a letter of introduction. Won't you go out and talk to these people and see why some people are successful and others are not, and develop a philosophy of success? And as Hill told it was, he didn't know it, but Carnegie had a stopwatch under the desk, was going to give him a minute to make up his
mind. 60 seconds. So in other words, I'll get back to you tomorrow, or let me sleep on
he
it.
He said it took 29 seconds.
29 seconds, okay.
Yeah,
so 31 seconds left on the watch.
He interviewed all these people, George Eastman, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison.
But here's the thing, how much money did he get paid to do this?
He didn't get paid anything at all, because basically he wanted to earn while he's learning. And Hill says he advanced him expense money, but he never paid him. But so he was to develop his philosophy as he went along, and he spent 20 years of doing that. But it must have turned out pretty well, because his first book was Law of Success, and then of course he wrote another little book, Magic Ladder to Success, and then 1937 he wrote Think and Grow Rich. And here's a guy that's able to go out and buy Rolls Royce with royalties right in the middle of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So evidently it turned out okay.
Yeah, so that's the story of Napoleon Hill. So just briefly, tell us the story of how the foundation came to be and how some of the background on yourself and how you, after your business career, or tell us a little bit about your own career and then how you came to be the CEO of the foundation.
Lots of folks start saying Hill wrote the material, but he never lived it. Well, I got a copy of his will. The last part went to his wife, and he gave away all the books and all, so I don't know the value of the rights.
Mm-hmm.
He gave them to a foundation he set up in 1962, a nonprofit with a motto of making the world a better place in which to live, which was just keeping his philosophy alive. All the book copyrights and all came to the foundation, the nonprofit foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And the $1.3 million, his wife, she spread it out. But anyway, the foundation really got off to a good start, and when he worked with W. Clement Stone for a 10-year period of time.
Mr. Stone being the very successful insurance company owner.
Yeah, right. He founded Combine Insurance
right.
on $100, and he gave away thousands and thousands of books, and I believe the material I have on him, the time he died at age 100, he'd given away somewhere around $450 million.
Wow.
His father was dead when he was 5 years old, but he really, really, really practiced material probably as good as anybody. He not only read it and read the other writers, but he put his money where his mouth was. He extended $500,000 to the foundation to publish the books and to promote the things, and the money was paid back without interest to him, as he requested. But he's one really got the foundation off on good, solid financial footing,
mm-hmm.
and it's been self-sustaining based on royalties and book sales since that period of time. And it's stronger today than it ever was.
And how did you come to be part of the foundation?
Well, Richard, I wrote about that in my book, because I've been in China 3 times and Singapore 3 times and Malaysia 3, Germany a couple of times, and all Costa Rica, Jamaica, lots and lots of places. And people would ask me that. So I thought, well, that'll be good. I was a bank president at the time. I did a little speech one night, and I wrote the foundation that night when I got home and I had my secretary at the bank. I was a bank president for
mm-hmm.
almost 20 years. And send the letter off and tell them that, Hill's from this area. I've done stuff. I've made speeches. I know about him and so forth. And so I get a letter asking me to come and have dinner in Chicago with the Board of Trustees. And Mr. Stone, I couldn't wait to meet the guy, and he said, we talked and we eat, and he finally looked at me and he said, you know more about these books than I do. He said, you ought to be a board member. And of course, I didn't need a job. I was a bank president, so I served as a trustee. And then as later on, the board members of the bank I ran they asked me, Don, so Somoza would like to sell the bank. We've been around a long time. We're getting up in years. And what would be the most we get out of the bank? And I said, well, we'd sell it to a competitor. I mean, or somebody else that wants the banking area. I said,
hey, Don, we've got to take a break. So we're going to finish the story when we come back.
Okay.
So just hang on. And we will be right back with It's Your Money and Your Life right here on 760 KFMB. Welcome back to It's Your Money and Your Life. We are Joe Vecchio-Less tonight. This is Richard Musio, but I'm not all by myself because I'm with Don M. Green, the CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation, and we're going to get into Don's new book. But Don, when we went to break, you were talking briefly about your background as a businessman and a banker, and you had a very successful career in banking, but I know as your career moved along and you ended up selling the bank out, that sort of freed up some time for you to, well, shall we say, pursue your passion, which are the teachings of Napoleon Hill and the reading and writing that you do. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct.
And so did you start with the foundation then just as a member of the board?
I was a member of the board, and about the time we sold the bank, the other CEO was Mike Ritt, and Mike had been around forever. He actually worked with Mr. Stone for 52 years,
wow.
And he ran the foundation, and his health had deteriorated where he could not travel and so forth, and they really needed someone. And they asked me, and I said, well, you know, I'd been involved in lots of things like cable TV and spring water and dry cleaning business and real estate development, what have you. I had enough to keep me busy.
Mm-hmm.
But they asked me to do it, and I said, yeah, I can do it, but I just don't want to live in Chicago, a nice place to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, what do you suggest? I said, I can move it to Wise. That's where Hill was from. I said, I can have space. And I said, I've got the books. All I need is the money transferred. And so now we're on our 13th year, and it's been great. And they've been very, very, very well pleased. They couldn't have asked for more of what we've been able to accomplish.
That's your stuff. But I want you to tell the story, because this is probably the funniest story in the book, the story about your first business when you were in high school and you, well, had a tourist attraction in your hometown.
Yeah, you know, my dad was a coal miner and seventh grade education. I had enough sense to not ask for money because he expected you to get up, he was up 10 or 12 years old, you can be mowing grass or you can do something other than earn you some money. He wasn't one you go to and say, Dad, I need $5 because the money didn't come that easy. And, my dad had a hobby, and some of the other guys did. They did things in the woods, like they dug ginseng, which is a cash crop, and they also in the summertime they would catch poison snakes, and you know just to do it, and it's not that hard. And so they knew that there was a place in Florida, some places that displayed them, and so we called some and turned them loose in a little pit beside the road, which was on our property, and I had some signs made up and called it Indian Mountain Reptile Garden, and didn't pay anything for the signs. I got a friend who drove a soft drink truck, get me some signs and put them up and nailed them on the trees, and started charging a quarter for see the snakes for adults and 10 cents for children. And then the money got good, so I started getting me some other animals. I got a monkey and another monkey and another monkey, and you know, things like a skunk and groundhogs. And my best deal was I bought a baby black bear from some Indians down in North Carolina. So and so many cars were stopping. First thing I got was I rented a drink machine. Got my dad to run electric wire down there to it to work and have electricity, and I started buying drinks and then things like crackers and so forth to sell. And then I had a few souvenirs, and then I got a little building thrown up and started selling all kinds of souvenirs. And I found out that I could buy some souvenirs for a quarter, put a little sticker on them that said Indian Mountain Reptile Garden, I could sell them for a dollar.
Yeah.
I told somebody later, make 3% on stuff, you can make some good money.
Yeah.
So it was a terrific business. It was just a summer, but all through high school and starting college, and it was a terrific business. And after I got in college, it was U.S. 23 that runs from Michigan to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the state bypassed us. They built a four-lane divided highway a few miles away. And, of course, by that time, I'm starting into college and so forth. But it was about, five summers. It was a terrific business. Made a lot of money and learned how to take care of it. And it was just a terrific experience dealing with people. and learning to market things.
But there's a really funny story in there, because you got a call one day at school because your attention was needed back at the business. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Tell that one, and then we'll get into the book.
On the intercom, that came a voice over from the principal's office. It says, "Is Don Green there?" I said, "If he is, he's got to go home right quick." It says, "His mother's on the phone. She scared his bar got out." And did he ever get out? He had been raised that way, and I had just a fence to surround the cages and so forth. He didn't try to break loose or anything. He was outside, and we had ducks and stuff run loose. Other than they killed one duck by smacking his head off. He never caused any problems. Mm-hmm. He just having the time of his life. The monkeys were in their cages screaming, going wild when I got there in my old 36 Ford. And the traffic was backed up, and my mother was saying, your daddy gets a hold of you or something like that. And she's scared and so forth. But I remember Monroe Moore was these little cake called Little Debbie's. I think they still make them, oatmeal cake with cream icing in it. And I got a dozen of the cakes off of the bread truck, and the animals can smell forever. And I started hollering at Sammy, and I threw the oatmeal cake towards him, and he come to it and eat it. And I kept backing it up and throwing him another, and backing it up and throwing him another. And, you know, he just swallowed him. I try the paper and throw it down in one bite. I got one left, and I got him to the door. So I pitched it inside the door. He sticks his head in there, going to get that oatmeal. I figure he's going to get it back out, so I'm behind him. So I kicked him in the butt, and he jumped in the cage, and I shut the door. What happened, I went there at morning to feed him, and I'd go in the morning and play with him early in the morning. I'd go back home, take a shower, and then I'd hitchhike to school.
Yeah.
Because the school bus didn't run through there and where we live in the country, out in the rural area. So I guess I would just shut the door, no doubt, and I hadn't stuck the lock down through the hasp, and he leaned against it.
And
I'm up in the morning, it come open, and old Sammy had his freedom. So
that's funny.
I thought it was funnier than the devil, but...
Yeah, other people didn't agree necessarily.
Other people didn't. I guess take him back. Now he could easily kill somebody.
Exactly.
He probably weighed 400 pounds.
So let's talk about your book that people can get through McGraw-Hill. Just a great book. It's called Everything I Know About Success I Learned from Napoleon Hill, and the subtitle is... Essential Lessons for Using the Power of Positive Thinking. So why did you want to write this book?
Well, you know, Richard, everywhere I would go, you know, even I taught a course 12 times that I originated here at the college at the University of Virginia where we're located, and I taught this material. I called it Keys to Success, based on one of Hill's books, The 17 Principles of Success. But people would just over and over, they would tell me I'd go to Aquinas, or I'd go to, and I spoke to thousands and thousands of people, and people say you ought to put that in a book, and then so I guess I thought, well, heck, our money goes to scholarships. We do prison work, and we're a nonprofit. I said, I don't need the money.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I can do a book, give the foundation the copyright, and give them all the proceeds of it, and we're raking a little bit of money. So I just started down putting it together, and wrote about things I was familiar with, and. McGraw-Hill, I guess, they were the first one that looked at it. They looked at the chapter, and they said, gosh, we'd love to have an option on doing your book. And so they've been more than well pleased. It turned out real well.
Yeah, it really did. I read it, and this is the kind of book where we would tell our listeners not only buy one for yourself, but buy about 10 extra and give them to your friends and business associates. Anyway, we have to take a quick break on It's Your Money and Your Life. Everybody hang on. We're going to be right Welcome back to It's Your Money and Your Life with Richard Musio and our very special guest, Mr. Don M. Green, the CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation. I want to, before I get back with our guests, I want to thank all of our sponsors. We couldn't do this without them. Our major sponsor, UBS, Mr. Michael Caronta and Mr. Drew Freitas, thank you very much. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow from their real estate operations. The Planet's Best CFO Service, Mr. Jason Kruger, CPA with Signature Analytics. Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton with Regions Bank. Our favorite CPAs who are crawling towards the finish line during tax season, Polito Epic CPAs. Paul Polito, by the way, Paul Polito in first place in our basketball pool. He may actually win this thing. It helps not to know anything about college basketball, huh, Paul? Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited, the best valuation resource west of the Mississippi. And Rich Gaines, the legacy attorney with Family Legacy Legal. Rich has got a great show coming up at the end of April, and a great event going on. I think it's on May 4th. I think that's coming up on my website. Information about that going up soon. And you can hit www.iymoney.com, our radio show's website, if you want links to all of our great sponsors. Again, thanks, everybody. We couldn't do it without you. So, Don, back to your book and back to some of the principles that Napoleon Hill sort of originated in his works, including Think and Grow Rich. So I remember the first sentence in Think and Grow Rich is this: it's thoughts are things. What does he mean by that?
Well, everything begins in our inner world. Our outer world is simply a reflection of our inner world, either good or bad. You know, you can wake up from morning and have thoughts of getting a drug, getting high, or you can have thoughts of what you're planning for the day to make it be a...
So you're saying that if I wake up and I go, well, I'm a failure, I can't do that right, I can't do this right, as opposed to if I wake up in the morning and say, well, today on my path to success, I'm going to accomplish this piece of my journey, whatever those steps or things might be. You're saying that if I have those positive beliefs and thoughts, I have a much greater chance of being successful than if I do otherwise. Is that it?
That's right. We tend to move in the direction of our thoughts, our most dominant thoughts. Hillwood said keep your mind on what you want and off your mind what you don't want. And of course, people that are in poverty, their mind is concentrated with poverty. And, you know, we tend to get and move in direction of what our dominant thoughts are. And it's just that it's really that important. And the thing is, of having positive thoughts in our mind is similar to someone compared to a garden. You've got to plant good stuff in a garden and take care of it. Otherwise, weeds are going to grow. And you can liken the weeds to negative thoughts. The mind is never completely at rest, even while we're asleep. The subconscious is working. I know you have things happen to you, and you wake up in the morning, and it's on your mind. You know, so our thoughts are absolutely important, and not only having the correct thoughts, but also acting on those that are positive and moving in the direction of. Right. Even though we may not know how to get there, if Richard was to say, "Don, let's you and I head out to Nashville, Tennessee," and we're bound and determined to go, we might not know all the steps. There's a little book that Viktor Frankl wrote. He was in the Auschwitz concentration camp mm-hmm. for 3.5 years. In Man's Search for Meaning, he wrote, it sold millions of copies. He said he noticed when somebody, he found out why they wanted to do something that was strong enough, they would find out the how to get there. So many people in life, I've found, are waiting till they know all the answers. We're not going to know all the answers. And if we wait till we know all the answers, we simply, more than likely, we don't start. So the main thing is having a positive thought and doing something other each day that moves you towards it. You may have to take a different route, may have to get advice from somebody else, and you may have to do a whole bunch of other things, change your plans, but you may not be able to do it in the time limit that you set for yourself. But you only reach the stage that we call failure when you quit trying.
Yeah, and so what you're alluding to here, you're saying that having great beliefs or positive beliefs isn't enough. You're saying you actually have to take action.
That was Mr. Stone's favorite thing. Is he actually? I've got some here on my desk. If you ever visit me, I'll hand you one of them. Mm-hmm. He did little labels that he gave people. It says, "Do it now." In other words, every what you got in mind is. It was the first class I taught in college when I did my notes, my syllables, my outline was. Two topics we talked about on the first night. One of them was someday. You know, we say someday I'm going to enroll in that night class. Someday I'm going to take that counting course.
And my joke is everybody has a big butt.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I do that, but.
Yeah, well, that's right. And someday, I told him, go home and look. Someday's not on the calendar. It's a polite way of blind yourself. I'm going to go on that. I'm going to lose this weight. I'm going to start an exercise program. I'm going to start saving money. I'm going to start paying more attention to my spouse. All these positive things is we put them off by saying someday. But someday is not on that. The past is gone. You can't put the baby back. And the future is not here. It's the only day we got today, and today's the time to start. But it's a polite way of lying to herself. And we have a good discussion on that someday, because that's a polite way of lying to yourself with postponing something or another. And the other one was, we talked about was half the class. The other half was talking about success. And of course, you get 50-some young people in a class and ask them what's success, and they'll scream out money. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, we'll name, if you know the local drug dealers or what have you, you would say those people are a success because they got a lot of money, they got the car and the gold chains around their necks and so forth. I said, no, that's probably not either. We each got to have our definition of success. But I love the words of author Ben Sweetland, who said a long time ago, success is a journey, not a destination. It simply means it's what we become during the process, because it's never complete. And the day we think, well, I've arrived, I got $1 million, or I got ever what. No, you know, we strive each day to improve ourselves. As Robert Browning said in one of his poems was, our reach must exceed our grasp for what's a heaven for. It's simply meaning that we need challenges in front of us to improve ourselves as long as we're here, because that's what keeps some of us going. And of course, a lot of people have just simply given up. They're in a survival mode. They're not really living.
Yeah, and this is interesting because, well, this is a financial show, so we can do statistics. Somebody asked the question, how many times do you think people tried doing something that they wanted to accomplish but ran into obstacles, so they didn't, and they gave up? How many efforts do you think they made before they quit? So you answer the question, because you know the answer to this question. What's the average amount of times that people try?
Yeah, that's one of the questions. Hill, I've got him on audio saying that, asking that. And he said, and somebody hollers 1, 2, 3, and 4. He said, no, I said the average. You got to factor in those people that didn't even start.
Yeah, it's less than
they
one.
Never even start.
Never start. It's less than one.
I love the finance part, because that's my background, 38 years of banking.
Yeah, but most people never even start. But what I love about your book, what I love about this book that you did, Don, is you describe, you know, some of your experiences in business, some of the Napoleon Hill experience, but then you put in very bold black letters certain truisms or things like, for example, I'll read one, obstacles are not there to block one's path, but to be used as stepping stones on the path of life. Another good one is, most of the fears that we let dominate our lives have no justification or basis. In fact, these are the dark black print, you know, highlights in your book that appear periodically as you're telling your story and the Napoleon Hill story. And I think it's really neat, because I think what you're alluding to, we've talked about beliefs and actions, but then there's this thing called habits, right? Your repetitive actions become ingrained in you, they become habits. And I think what you're saying is, to be successful, you have to develop successful habits. Or on the other hand, if you're not, you've probably developed habits that are making you not successful. Can you talk a little bit about
the habits? You know, it's really something. Is I reduce it down to kind of simple things, and I'm told that we make our habits, and then our habits make us. It doesn't matter whether the habits are good or bad; they'll define us. And I can give you an example. I had an uncle who was 90 some years old. I handled his finances. He had one bad habit, which was smoking, and he lit up one time in church. Now, he wasn't crazy. He wasn't crazy. I mean, you know, he was well-to-do. Yeah. But he had such a habit that, you know, it gets right in the church, or the preacher's talking in too low a tone or something. But, you know, after a while, people, they reach for a cigarette and they light it up. And, you know, and he did it with this, you know, involuntary. It's like you go to work same day, every way you go to the same bit and all, and you're so used to turning. But one day you're supposed to make a go cut off somewhere to pick up the morning newspaper or something or other. And, you know, and you don't do it because of habit. You've done it over and over again until you don't even think. You know, you just do it, and it's the same way with smoking. So it doesn't matter where it's a good habit or a bad habit. When we do things, it's so routine. I said, that's the reason you're talking about personal finance, the richest man in Babylon. When an old guy covered that with me when I was a real young age, he said, was basically what the thing means is, if you can't save a little bit when you're making a little bit, chances are you're not going to save any or invest it when you get older, because something consumes it. And it's not the amount of money that you save, it's the habit you establish, which is important. I don't care if it's $2 a month. You know, if you do that religiously, some point in time, you'll get to where you're making more money, and you can increase it to $10 a month or $20 a month. Or if you're really, really good, you'll get up some point in time, you can save half your salary because you've taken care of stuff. You got this other income coming from all these other sources out there that you've done over a period of years, and all of a sudden, you know, you're looking like you're a real bright feller.
Mm-hmm. All right, we got it. Boy, this is flying by. We've got to take one break. We'll be back for the last quarter with Don M. Green, CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation, on It's Your Money and Your Life. Stay with us. We are heading down the home stretch, rounding third base, heading towards home on It's Your Money and Your Life with the CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation, Don Green. Don, how can our listeners get a hold of you? What's your contact information, and how can they buy your book?
Okay, our website is www.naphill.org. That's NAPHILL.org. My office phone is 276-328-6700.
Okay, and how do people get a hold of the book?
They get a hold of the book. It's on Amazon. It's been on Amazon as a pre-order, and it's been absolutely great.
Great.
It's been shipped. I don't even know how many hundred copies I've signed. I can't believe the people that wanted to buy the book and wanted me to sign them and mail them out to them. I've signed about... I guess I've signed close to 1,000 already.
Well, good for you.
In a matter of a few days.
Good for you.
It's been great. Every how they choose, it'll be in Books A Million, it'll be in Barnes and Noble's, and it's on Barnes and Noble's website. It's on Amazon. It's on Powell's Books. It's on McGraw Hill.
Okay, great. Yeah, get the publishers McGraw Hill
on the our website www.naphill.org, and it'll click you on to where you can order the book, or you know you can buy it in a store. It's okay. Also a Kindle. It's available on your iPad on a Kindle, and it'll be an audio. I'm not real sure what date the audio is out. They call me sometime back and asked me to read the book, and would I want to? And I told them I would prefer someone else, and they said authors like to be offered that opportunity. And I said, well, I think I appreciate the opportunity, but I think someone else might sound better and can leave out some of the pauses and what have you. And
we've got the Southern drawl.
Well, that's what Gary Goldstein that endorsed my book. You know, he's a guy that produced the movie Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
And that's what Gary said. I had a Southern drawl. I said, well, as I told those prisoners up in Indiana one time, one of them asked me about, I said, you're not my Peoria. I said, no, don't sound like you are either. I said, where are you from? He said, Bluefield, West Virginia, which is a couple hours.
Yeah.
I said, what are you doing in this place? And he said, I come up to visit, and I got some trouble. I said, well, you can tell these other guys in here, if they ever have a chance to live down south, it'll take them about 6 months to learn how to talk.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I have to learn how to speak the language. Hey, what you're talking about, though, is a journey that shouldn't be taken alone. There's a great quote in the book that's about collaboration. It says, share your ideas with other people of vision who can assist you on your journey to success. So you're talking there about finding a mentor, maybe being a mentor, collaborating with other people. Can you talk a little bit about the collaborative themes that are in your book?
Yeah, Richard, I know you will attest to this. It's amazing how successful people are the one that has the most time to help other people out. I think it's they have a feeling that they can give back. As even John D. Rockefeller said, he didn't feel a duty to give, but a privilege to be able to. And I think that's the same way. And who would have thought some kid sitting down here in a town with three red lights to write W. Clement Stone, a billionaire, and get a reply back and said, pay you way to come and have dinner with me. It's amazing when you people... I was working on a book project, and I called Sharon Lecter. You know, Sharon was CEO of the Rich Dad Poor Dad for 9 years and did 14 books that sold 30, 40 million copies. And I picked up and I said, hey, Sharon, I said, told her who it was, and I'd met her before. I said, I got a book project. I've stuck on it working with a guy, and I said, I made a trip to New York. I said, I started and did some of the interviews, but I said, it really needs somebody to take the book and finish it. And she said, oh, I'd be honored to. And then she needed it. And, I said, now, wait a minute. I said, it belongs to the foundation. And I said, we get the proceeds from it and so forth. So she starts laughing. She said, I'll be glad to help. She said, I read Think and Grow Rich as a 19-year-old, and I was going to college, and I later a CPA, and I worked in investments in the finance industry. And she started a little company that made reading children's books and sold out, and she's been tremendously successful. So it's amazing when you reach out to people that's been successful that are willing to give back. And you know, we can learn from our parents, but there's plenty of people. And I said, that's the reason of reading good books. I don't expect anybody to read Think and Grow Rich and memorize everything that's in it and be able to do it. But the thing of it is, reading these books, you know, we all like to read some of the novels or what have you, and find out how the story ends. Does the boy get the girl? Did uncle die and leave him their millions, or whatever? What? We have to read the whole thing. But in these books, and like the literature that you put out, and the books like this is, you take this information, you study it, and you see where you can apply it, and you write your own life story. You don't have to read somebody else's ending of some novel or whatever. You can plan your own life by doing the right things through financial planning. I say it's races down to learning, earning, and sharing, and we can do them all at the same time.
Yeah, so tell us about learning, earning, and sharing, because that's sort of, well, it sort of leads to legacy. I mean, learning is what you do when you're younger. You find out what your passion is, you study.
It really is, you know, and you're talking about finance, and we'll talk about that some other time, of just finance, but Eisenhower had a good quote, he said, if all you demanded in life was a roof over your head, clothes on your back, and food, said you get all three of them items in prison.
Mm-hmm.
That's survival, and that's the people have not handled their finances and not done the right things, followed the wrong principles. They're out here just surviving. They're really not living. And I said, of all the books I've read, and thousands of them, I've read thousands of books, and I think it comes down to about four things. The first one we just talked about, surviving. And the second one is, we may not always be able to work. That's the reason they listen to your show and they get financial advice, mm-hmm. is because I call it a rainy day. You know, may lose a job and they'll fall you on because it may be because of health you can no longer work. So that's the second reason to have money, is for I call it a rainy day. And the third reason is to lead what I would call a good life. If you come home one day, your wife says, Richard, honey, said there's a new restaurant. Everybody's talking about it. It's real expensive, but I'd love to go. And you look at her and say, yeah, it sounds good. I've not paid the car payment or the house payment.
Right.
So it really takes some money, and money is not the most important thing. But as I did a fundraiser with Zig Ziglar one time, he said people that say money is not important said you better be careful, said, because they'll lie about the rest of the stuff.
Yeah.
So money is important, and so that's the third reason, is have good life so you can travel, you can eat out, you can do things that makes life more enjoyable. And then the fourth reason to have the money is because it puts you in a position where you can help other people of other causes of your choosing.
Right, that's the sharing part. But I found that successful people can not only share money, they can share their experiences, their expertise, the network that they've created.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, bring resources to bear.
I can explain in our program the stories I got of kids that I've helped. One little girl that worked for me 6 years, looks like she's 12 years old. I let her go to work. She was in high school, worked 6 years, kind of watched her, and she worked her 6 years through college, through pharmacy school, starts off $125,000 a year. Her dad's an underground coal miner. You don't know what a good feeling that is to see that happen to kids, and I've had others the same way. And then sometimes they're adults. You know, the story in there, if you read it, the guy in Nigeria, how many people in Nigeria will send you $250,000 because they read some books?
It's just an amazing story.
Not that you was expecting that, but anytime we do the golden rule and we share it, we may not get it back directly. It may not be nothing but a good feeling, which is a reason to do it. But I call it sowing and reaping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't go out in the garden and pick corn if you never planted none. How can you expect to have good results when you haven't done anything to deserve them? But so many people are waiting to sow the corn after they've done repick corn, and they got it backwards. And it relates to everything we do. You know, I told the story about one of my mentors telling me many, many years ago, he said, you know, if you do a little extra one day, nobody might notice. They might not notice for a week or a month. But if you continue to do that throughout life, one day you'll be the success that most people are just dreaming about. And so that's the stages we go through with, is learning, earning, and sharing. And all three of them is necessary, I think, to have a good life. I've got a couple of brothers that did a lot of missionary work. As I told one of them one day is, you know, if we're not careful, when we die, ain't nobody know we've been here.
Yeah, that'd be a shame.
You know, and that would be sad. And I told a CBS on an interview once, I said, if we leave this world, they may recognize us with a statue or a plaque or something other, but it won't be for what we got in life. It'll be for what we gave back. You know, nobody cares what kind of watch you got or how much it costs or what kind of house you got. Even your relatives probably don't, or what kind of car you're driving. But if they can say, all right, guy, he got a bunch of kids scholarship, or he got that kid into medical school, or he got those kids to go to scholarship and finish school, disabled finish school, then hopefully that's what we've put here for. I mean, sure as anything, we've put here to serve one another.
Yeah, and that's the key question when you meet somebody, is to ask the question, how may I serve?
Yeah.
Hey, and I hear music. Everybody who's listening, go out and not only buy the book for yourself, buy the book for all of your friends and business associates by Don M. Green. Everything I Know About Success, I Learned from Napoleon Hill. Don, really appreciate your time, and good luck,
Richard,
with the book. Again, it's a must-read for everybody. Very much appreciated, Don. Thank you.
I appreciate you. Thanks.
All right, and thanks to Justin Hart, Dave Sniff, Craig Blanke, everybody who helps out here at the studio. We'll be back next Sunday on It's Your Money and Your Life. Everybody have a great week. Thank you.